So a lot was recently made about a piece that appeared on Deadspin with the headline, "The NFL needs to speak out against a Kansas City Chiefs fan in blackface native headdress." The article, written by Karen Phillips, concerned a 9-year-old kid named Holden Armenta, who showed up at a recent Chiefs game in some sort of Native American headdress and his face painted black. That's what the photograph accompanying the Deadspin article showed, kid in blackface. Only, it wasn't quite that. The kid's face was painted half black, half red, Chiefs colors. And while one can certainly debate whether that was cool or whether the headdress crossed the line, it is indisputable that Deadspin fucked up. Holden's parents are now threatening to sue the site, Phillips, the publisher, as well as Great Hill Partners. And journalistically, it begs a bigger question of Deadspin. Where was the editor? Where was someone with enough clout and wherewithal and knowledge to say, are we sure he's wearing blackface? Are we sure we want to plaster a 9-year-old kid on our site? Are we sure we want to do this? And as media crumbles and more decisions are left to the incapable, more mistakes like this will happen. It is a dangerous road to walk. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, speaks with another writer every single week. And today's guest is David Black, the founder and president of the David Black Literary Agency. David is the literary agent. He's repped everyone from Jimmy Breslin and Hank Aaron to Wolfgang Puck and Tom Verducci and Jonathan Eig and Anne Byrne and Alan Shipnuck and Mitch Albom and, well, me. This is episode number 341. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you're culturally irrelevant.
All right, well, David Black, my longtime agent. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start with this. I've written 10 books. My first book came out in 2003. It was with a different agent named Susan Reed, who left the business. Then I became a David Black client in those almost two decades, which is crazy. There's always been a lot of like, books, the sky is falling. Not from you, just the business in general. Books and the Kindle's coming. The Nook is coming. Digital, blah, blah, blah. It's dying. But I'm still writing books and they still seem to be doing okay. And, you know, my friends who you rep, Anne Byrne and Jonathan Eig and Ian O'Connor, still writing books, still surviving. Where is this business as we sit here in 2023?
This business has changed dramatically in those 20 years. The best way I can describe it is that publishers in the past would look to amplify an author's vision, seeking to broaden their audience. Increasingly, what they are looking to do is they are looking for the author to reach their audience. That inward seeking way of looking to publish a book is ultimately going to do them a real disservice. They won't be expanding on your vision or on an author's vision. That's going to be problematic. You're going to end up with books that are ephemeral instead of long lasting. Because if you can reach, you know, you can reach your audience, and that's great. But if you're not going that far beyond that audience, how else are people going to be able to come to those books? Your books, for example, to take you and to take John and Ian and Anne, all as good examples. These are books that people will be reading for years to come. They're going to read John's King book for decades. All right. They're going to, you know, somebody wants to read about Bo Jackson, they're going to read that book. They want to learn about Walter Payton, they're going to read Sweetness. Those books have a purpose. And that purpose is one where the world will come to them. If you are a celebrity who is looking to cash in the moment, that's fine. You'll reach an audience. But the way that books have always worked more than anything else is by word of mouth. Okay. You know, and people read that to say, hey, that was really good. You got to read that. Check that out. Yo, damn, that was good. That was some good shit. Read that. And you look at books. Now, I'll give you an example of one that was published, I guess, about a year ago. You know, I didn't have anything to do with, right? It was Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus, mm-hmm. The novel. that book came out. It started doing, you know, it was doing well. It hit the bestseller list, and it was sort of in the middle of the bestseller list and through the end of last year. And then all of a sudden we get to the beginning of the year and it's at the top of the list and it stays there. And the answer is clear. People were given that book for the holidays. They loved it and they began to talk about it. And as that happened, they kept selling more and more and more copies. It's not rocket science.
It seems like, but I could be totally wrong here. Back in the day when I started, someone would come along with an idea and it would be, I really want to write a memoir about my dog and his, you know, and the lake I live by. And it would be some writer, maybe Town and Country magazine, and a publishing company would pay $20,000 and take a shot on this unknown writer because maybe it'll hit and we make enough money off of Bill Clinton's biography or whatever that we can do it. It seems like companies are not taking those chances in the way they once did. Is that fair?
That's sort of the proverbial conversation about the death of the midlist, right? Which were the books that you would roll the dice on. And yeah, people are, they want the big hits. That's what they want. They need Billings. What Billings are is it's when they ship out books, they get paid within like 60 or 90 days. Right. So if they have a big book, they're going to send out a lot of books. They're going to see a lot of money to their bottom line within 60 to 90 days. That smaller book, they're only going to get out a small number of copies. That's not going to move their needle. So they have less incentive when they have more corporate pressure on earnings to publish to the little books than the big ones.
Someone will say to me, someone, maybe a Sports Illustrated writer, like a Newsday writer, would be like, hey, I really want to write a book. It's a story of my grandpa and our time sledding in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And I always say, often will say, I'm not saying that is a bad idea for a book. But I think if you want to have a sustained career, it may not be the book to start your career with.
That's correct.
It is correct. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I'm just shitting on someone's dream a little bit.
You're giving them a reality check. Because of the way that the business is structured, how your books sell is really important. If you sell 100,000 copies of your first book, the next time that you publish, the retailers are going to base their orders upon the sales of that 100,000 copy book. If you sell 2,000 copies of a book, almost regardless of what the idea is, and I'm not saying that's right, I'm saying it's wrong, but because of that, they're only going to take a couple of thousand copies or 1,000 copies. And so the publisher is then stuck with whatever money they paid you because they can't get books out the door. So the idea needs to be, you know, the way I just have always described it is you become a prisoner to your numbers. You and I have talked in your career about the books you do and, you know, the books you want to write that, you know, you are going to write this memoir, right? Mm-hmm. About your time in Nashville.
Yeah.
You are hell-bent to write this memoir because it's going to be fun and it's going to be funny and it's going to be interesting and it'll be great. It'll be great for any young journalist. It'll be great for people who've come to know you. And by this point in your career, you have a lot of people who come to know you. That's good. But if you were starting your career, we wouldn't turn to that and say, okay, that's the book that you're going to write because we don't know what the audience is for that book. And the more we know, the better off you are.
I haven't talked to her in years and years, but Susan Reed coming to me 20 something years ago and saying, have you ever thought about doing a book about the 86 Mets? That kind of changed my life, you know?
Yeah, bless her.
Wait, so you've been around a long time. You've represented a lot of people. And the first guy I knew you rep was Mitch Albom. Obviously, Mitch Albom, known as a longtime writer, Tuesdays with Mari. How did you wind up repping Mitch Albom?
I was in Michigan to see Gary Pomerantz, a writer you may know. Mm-hmm. He was taking time away from the Washington Post to take a journalism class at the University of Michigan. It was like a journalism fellowship. And while I was there, I was reading the Detroit Free Press. And I was reading these columns by this guy who I thought was really talented. And then I went into a Borders bookstore and saw a copy of a collection of columns called Live Album. And I bought it. I read it. I got back to New York. I tracked Mitch down. And I said, you should be writing real books, not simply a collection. He said, let's meet next time I'm in New York. We met at some place in Greenwich Village and agreed to work with each other. And I said, the first thing you do is look in your backyard. The best stories are often, particularly for journalists, those that are closest to them. And he called and said, what about an autobiography of Bo Schembech, the longtime head coach of Michigan football? And I said, I can sell that. I sold that to Larry Kirschbaum, who was at Warner Books then, who was a rabid Michigan alumnus. The book became a big success. He then wrote the Fab Five about the Michigan basketball team, then came to me and said, I want to write this book about my old college professor. I want to help retire his medical bills, and I want to write this. And I said, okay. What I did is I went back to that who is option publisher and said, you know, I had like a 6-page letter, and that letter is actually the, he's just released the 25th anniversary edition of that book. And that letter is the new material in that book. So that's actually a really good letter to read for people who are looking to sort of see how you describe a book. And his publisher called me and said, I can't buy this book. He's a sports writer. This is more of a memoir. I don't know why he's doing this. And I begged him not to turn it down. I said, you have a really good relationship with this guy. Don't say no. He has his finger on the pulse of his audience in a way that's truly unique. He said, I can't publish this. I said, okay. 14 million copies later.
So did you ever have a conversation with the guy who turned it down about turning it down?
Oh, absolutely. I saw him about a year or so later, or 2 years later, after the book was out. I think I saw him at a party or was somewhere in Manhattan. He comes up. He says, I'm furious with you. I said, what the fuck are you so mad at? He said, you didn't sell me that book. I said, what the hell is wrong with you? I begged you to buy that book. And he looked at me and he gave me a hug and he kissed me on the top of my head. He was a lot taller than I am. That's not hard. And he said, okay, you're right. And that was it.
Wait, I just want to say, Tuesdays with Mari, it was on the New York, it was at the top of the New York Times combined bestseller list for 23 weeks. And then it remained on the Times bestseller list for years and is still the best-selling memoir of all time.
Yes.
What is it about that book, that author, that time period, whatever, that equals that success?
I've had a lot of conversations with Mitch about this too. Many people have a Maury in their life, and I'm not saying that Maury was anything other than wonderful. Mm. Okay. He was a man who had great wisdom, but many people have people in their lives who have great wisdom. People came to this book because Mitch wrote it as a 37-year-old man who had gotten to a point in life where he wasn't paying attention to what was most important. And as he depicted himself in that book, people could see themselves in Mitch. And as they saw themselves in Mitch, there was a way that they could be comfortable with the discomfort of what he was writing about. Mm. So, yes, that was me. Or that has been me. Or that is me. I can change. Look how he has changed. I can learn. So I actually think that the reason that that book succeeded is because people related to Mitch and said, I've been there.
Does it get exhausting? People knowing you represented Mitch Albom and pitching you memoir of me and my horse, memoir of me and my grandpa, memoir of me and my nanny.
I don't take unsolicited manuscripts in large part because, you know, and you know this, when you reach out to me, I'm pretty responsive.
Very.
And I work to be as almost instantaneously responsive as I can. I get an enormous number of referrals. That's the way I build a business, right? Is on those referrals, people that you've suggested that I've talked with, all sorts of different people. And so I pay attention to those. But if I were to pay attention to all of those, to unsolicited stuff, there wouldn't be a moment in the day. And as is, I said to my assistants the other day, I said, you got to help me with some of these referrals. I'm spending 5 to 10 hours a week talking with people who it's really important that I connect with. But 98% of them, unfortunately, don't have stuff that I can, that I see a path towards selling.
Right.
If I could see a path towards selling it, I would do it.
Do you have a miss? Like, do you look back and think, well, that was one I should have jumped on?
Yeah, probably, but I don't think about it. I mean, the only way to really do this effectively is, I think, in some ways is to be a horse with blinders on. You can't look side to side. And I don't mean that from an arrogant perspective, quite the contrary. I mean, there's Publisher's Lunch, right? Which talks about the sales that are made on a daily basis. I can barely look at that. I always feel completely inadequate every time I look at that. So I don't think about, I think about what I'm doing and try and work to focus my time with those clients, helping them make their stuff as good as I can make it so I can find a market for things.
How'd you get your first client?
Cold call.
Who was your first client?
My first client was Steve Friedman. He was the executive producer of the Today Show. I called him and said, you know, he had taken the Today Show from third place to first place. This was in the early 80s or mid 80s. And he said, I can't tell that story. I want to write a novel. It took years to get that together, but he was my first client.
Why did you even become a literary agent? What was the pull of this sort of gig?
I was working in a mailroom at ICM. Didn't know what I wanted to do. I worked in the music department. I think I worked for a day or so in the film department. Then I worked for literary agent. My father had worked in the publishing business for 50 years before he passed away. And the last thing I thought I wanted to be was literary agent. But I began working for an agent there, and I was looking at material, and I began to realize that I understood what made a book and why. Nobody would hire me to be their assistant at ICM. I went to work for a television development company. My boss was fired 6 weeks after I got there. I stayed for 4 months, then went to work at a literary agency, answering phones and typing letters, because then you were typing letters. And after a few years, my boss came to me and said, you're doing a really good job. You're showing up on, 9 o'clock. You're working until 6 o'clock. But he said, if you really want to make it in this business, you got to approach this a little differently. And so I began coming in at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. I began going out, getting the Washington Post, looking for articles. I would read through Newsday, looking for articles and looking at for writers. And I began calling people. I said, hey, you want to write a book? And within a few years, I was selling an enormous number of books and built a business from there. I was an agent there for 2.5 years and then struck out on my own.
Did you know what you were doing?
I knew what I was doing as an agent. I'd done it for a few years. I had questions. I would call other agents to ask questions when I had them. But I had a pretty firm footing. I'd been in an agency for 5.5 years before I struck out on my own. I was an agent for 2.5 before I left. It's about paying attention. It's not that hard.
I always am asked, oh, how do I find an agent? How do I find an agent? And the advice I usually give is go to a bookstore, find a book similar to what you're writing, go to the acknowledgement section. They always thank the agent, see who the agent is, and reach out to them. But that seems a little simplistic. Is there a good way to find an agent?
I give the same advice, because what I'm saying to people is, if somebody writes me a letter or an email and says, I read the following books and see that you represented those writers, either I admired their work or this is similar to their work, I'm going to pay attention to that, because they've done their homework. That's flattering. You can't ever look at stuff and think, oh my God, why would I talk to somebody? That's just wrong. This is a business of relationships, and you never know. You never know where it's going to come from or where it's going to come. I was representing a guy that had an agent who worked with me for a number of years. He left. When he left, he went on somewhere else. He left his clients, and one of his clients had a book that I took care of and oversaw, and I cared for him. And then one day he called and he said to me, I have a friend who I think needs a literary agent. I said, who is that? He said, well, it's this guy who took the photographs for the Obamas for the last 8 years. A week or so later, I found myself in Washington having dinner with Pete Souza and sold his book, An Intimate Portrait. And it has probably sold 600,000 or 700,000 copies by now.
Did you know when you heard Obama's photographer, Pete Souza, wants to meet? Did you know immediately, like, there's obviously something here, or do you have to meet him?
Oh, yeah. It don't take much to know, right? Many times when you see it, you know it, because you answer the question, who's going to buy it, right? I could answer that question. This was before the election, I believe. But, you know, I knew that there would be enormous nostalgia for this president who was so extraordinarily photogenic.
I always tell people, but again, I'm not sure I'm right. It's kind of a guess that a book proposal, it's not really about why this is a great book. It's about why this is a great book that can sell. Fair, or is that, am I thinking too far in that?
It's not that you're thinking too far, but the thing that's really important is that these books, when you write a proposal, they should not be, do not oversell. Let the story sell itself. I've had this conversation with editors over time. So how many proposals do you get in a week? 20, 25? Okay. How many books do you buy in a year? 10, 15, maybe 20? Okay. So, you run the math, right? 50 weeks a year, 25 proposals a week, 1,250 proposals. Let us say they bid on 30 they don't buy, right? They say no 1,200 times.
Yeah.
Okay. They're pitched to within an inch of their lives. The most important thing that writers can do is to respect that and to really work to articulate the book that they want to write, the story they want to tell, who is possibly going to read it, and why they're going to read it. And if people are trying to think about, do I want to write a book? Answering those questions. Who's going to read this? Why do they want to read this? If you can't answer that, how is an editor going to be able to go in and talk to a sales director, a marketing director, and other editorial people and say, we should invest in this?
Right.
But don't oversell it. Let the story sell itself.
You represent a good friend of mine. I think he became a good friend of mine because you represent him. Jonathan Eich, whose book, King of Life, nominated for a National Book Award, made the bestseller list. It's one of the best biographies I've ever read. I truly say that, not just because I'm friends with him. And I wonder, when he came to you with this idea of I want to do Martin Luther King, are you immediately like, oh, great idea? Or are you like, well, there have been a lot of books on this subject?
There was a lot to talk about when John came to me with that idea. The first thing I said is, what's new? What's fresh? What's different? We can't sell this if there's nothing new and nothing fresh. And so he did the work and he found the places where there was new material. And then we had a very bluntly deal with the idea that this was a white man writing about a biography of a black icon in the 2020s.
I do know something about that now.
Yes, you do. You know, I am a firm believer, obviously, that people should not be stopped from writing books about people of other races or other ethnicities, but they need to give them incredible respect. As you're writing this book about Tupac, you have an even greater responsibility because you are writing about a world that you did not grow up in, to be able to depict that world in a way that is fair, honest, and accurate. And it's a lot harder for you because you didn't live in that. And it's a lot harder for John to write about King because he could not know what it was like to live in a black man's skin.
Right.
And he worked really, really hard. And the book stands up to that. And I think you saw yesterday that book was optioned.
Yeah.
Chris Rock read the book, said that he wanted to direct it, and asked Steven Spielberg to back him up as a director. Let's hope it gets made.
Obviously, for Ig, that's a huge deal and a huge moment of pride. Do you feel like you get a similar boost of pride when this stuff happens to a client?
Absolutely. When winning time hit the air, you know, this was a dream come true for you.
Yeah.
You know, you sit there like a proud papa every time it happens.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang, oh, that's the name of the podcast, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my dad, Stan Perlman, who's wearing a throwback Herschel Walker New Jersey Generals jersey from RoyalRetros.com. Dad, I'm confused. Why Herschel Walker?
You know, there just aren't that many Jews who play professional sports, so I wanted to support one of our greatest.
Dad, Herschel Walker's not Jewish.
Herschel Shmuel Walker, he most certainly is. I went down to Wrightsville, Georgia in 1977 to attend his bar mitzvah at the Wrightsville Ramada. Pickled herring was served. Wonderful time.
Dad, maybe it's senility, but Herschel Walker definitely isn't Jewish. He's Christian. He loves Trump. He thinks the earth is flat.
Why ruin an old man's dreams?
I want to go over a few of your clients and just tell me what comes to mind or what experience. Some random ones, okay? You represented the late Jimmy Breslin. Guy's a legend of all-time legends. What was it right like repping Breslin?
The phone would ring almost every morning. What do you got? What do you got? Jimmy, I'm a literary agent. I don't have anything for you. I don't have anything. And he said, all right. And then there was a time I called him and I said, it was after the recession, in the recession of 2008, 2009. And I said, Jimmy, I said, I was at my local butcher and I was talking to him. I said, so how's business? He said, business is actually really, really good. It's better than it usually is. He said, they're buying more stuff, cheaper cuts of, but cheaper stuff than they were when times were better. And he had a big, he had a ledger out in his hands. I said, what's that? I said, John, tell me what that is. He said, it's my rent rolls. I said, what do you mean it's your rent rolls? He said, I own buildings. I said, buildings? This is in Brooklyn. Uh-huh. He said, yeah. I said, how many buildings? He said, dozens and dozens of buildings. I said, where? He said, all around here. He said, holy shit. So I got back home and I called Jimmy. And I said, James, I just met a guy. He says he's got dozens and dozens of buildings. Let's say it's 36. Jimmy, there are none of these buildings that are less than $1 million to $2 million. This guy is worth at least $50 million and he's cutting ham hocks. And I said, this is a Jimmy Breslin story. And until he died, Jimmy would pick up the phone and he would say, I'm going to get to your fucking butcher. I'm going to get to your fucking butcher. And he never did.
You rep Hank Aaron. What was Hank Aaron like to represent as a literary agent?
I saw Henry as, first it was, I was young. I was probably 27. And we sold that book very specifically, telling his story as his story paralleled the civil rights movement. Mm. I began to realize, at least at that time in his life, that he felt to me as somewhat of a reluctant hero. He did what he had done. He was proud of what he accomplished. Felt a little reluctant to be the icon for talking about playing as a black man and the struggles he had. And I think he grew into that role as years went on. He then became much more comfortable with it. But when I knew him and was working with him, he was just growing into it.
You represent a lot of chefs and food-related folks, including my friend Ann Byrne, who was the took over for me as the food writer in the Nashville, Tennessee, long ago. And you represent Wolfgang Puck. When you're dealing with chefs, it has to be drastically different than dealing with just like sports writers. Like what is sure. involved with selling a cookbook?
One of the things that's always interesting about chefs is they are used to having complete control. Ain't no dish leaves that kitchen without them looking at that dish and checking that dish out. When they get into the book business, they don't always have the same level of control. That can be a little different and difficult for them. But they all get there. They all begin to understand it. And the thing about chefs and people in the food world that is so wonderful is that they're all doing it in one way or another to make people happy. It's an underlying reason for what they do. And that's pretty special. And that's kind of fun. because there's a great warmth to them as a community.
You represent my friend and former colleague, Alan Shipnuck. And Shipnuck's had quite a year. And I feel like every day someone in golf is taking a shot at him or firing off something about him. When you have a client and he kind of becomes a lightning rod, are you as an agent, are you just like, this is great, this is the best thing ever? Or are there greater repercussions that you have to think about to a certain degree?
You and I have talked about this too. What you write becomes permanent, and you have to be very careful about the impact of what it is you're saying. Alan knows full well what he's saying in these books. He is well aware that there are going to be people who find it funny, people who get mad, people, you know, who come at it from lots of different perspectives. Great reporters develop a thick skin. No reporter isn't at some point vulnerable. No writer isn't at some point vulnerable, because you are sitting alone in a room looking at a screen at some point creating the work that you're creating. So as much as he knows what's coming, and I'm sure he's fine with a lot of it, I'm always concerned. I will always say to a writer, it does not make sense to go out and burn bridges for the sake of burning bridges. That's not what's important. That's not what is necessary. I will regret to my dying day when I represented Will Chamberlain. And when I saw the line in that book talking about the fact that he had claimed to have slept with 20,000 women, I called him and I said, Wilton, I said, I don't know this is a good idea. He said, David, any publicity is good publicity. I said, Will, it's all anyone's going to talk about. I said, you wrote this book by yourself in longhand. This is what they're going to talk about. That's okay, dude. I will regret to my dying day that I didn't push back and tell him, take it out.
Why?
Because I think that it had a real impact on his legacy. He may have been, if not the greatest, arguably one of the greatest athletes in American history. He was so extraordinarily talented, and that's not the way he's being remembered.
It is kind of bonkers that no one ever mentions him, ever, in the argument for greatest player of all time.
It is. When people would say to him, you don't score enough, the next year, he led the league at 50 points a game.
Yeah.
When people said, you don't dish the ball off enough, the next year, he led the league in assists. He could do whatever he wanted to do. And by the way, he was an awfully warm and generous man.
That's what I heard, actually. Like a really good guy, actually.
Oh, he's a great man.
And he averaged 30 points a game for his career.
Yeah.
And 50.4 in one season.
That was the year they said you don't score enough.
The next year, he averaged 44. Like, it's just insane. Let me ask you a final question here. I feel like when I think of you as an agent, I oftentimes think, I've probably mentioned this before, the character Ari Gold from Entourage. And I say it as a compliment, which is, you're like a badass. I always say to my wife, I'm like, he's just a badass motherfucker. Like, you don't take shit. You stand up for your clients. You're a bulldog. I feel like half the time the people at the public, they like respect you, but they're also like, oh, black is coming. You know, like there's that level of like, he's not going to take shit. He's not just going to roll over. There are a million different agents out there. Does an agent need to be kind of aggressive and sort of hard charging and take no shit? Or would you say that is just one way of doing it and it is your way of doing it? Or am I mischaracterizing it?
I think I was probably much more hard charging earlier than I am now. Yeah. At the same time, I don't take any shit. My feeling is I love my people. Don't fuck with my people. Okay. And I feel that very strongly. But I also feel that there are ways to be effective with publishers. The more I've done this, the more I understand what is going on with them, what they need, what their concerns are. The more I understand that, the more I am able to navigate what my client needs. in a way that is going to be most effective for them.
Yep.
If they start pushing back for what I see is a corporate reason and not a reason that has any impact on my clients, you know, the way that I have always done it is to be incredibly persistent and not backing down. And eventually, if I just keep coming at them and coming at them and coming at them, you know, I've been able to affect the kind of change that I want to. But I'm not looking, I look at the relationship with the publisher as a partnership and not as an adversarial one. There are moments that a publisher has to defend their particular corporation. I understand that. I respect that. Saying no for the sake of saying no doesn't wash for me, though. And when you start doing that, that's when I push back. And that's when I say, uh-uh.
I feel like I've been well represented through the years, I have to say.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Let me ask you a final question. Like me, you've lived through Richard Todd and Pat Ryan and Freeman McNeil and Al Toon. You lived through the butt fumble. You lived through Lyle Alzado ripping off Chris Ward's helmet. You've lived through missed field goals. You lived through Denver Jets 10, Denver nothing at halftime. You're watching the opening game this season. Four plays in, Aaron Rodgers, Achilles. Is that the most Jet thing that has ever happened?
I think without question. I mean, my seats were in a direct straight line to where Rodgers went down. And I sat there with my son, who had come up from Asheville, North Carolina, to go with his dad to the game, something we'd been doing for 21 years, excited in ways and allowing ourselves to get excited in ways that we hadn't in years. And I saw him fall down and sort of rock back to try and stand up and then fall down again. And at that point, I knew that it was bad. If the air could have collectively gone out of 80,000 people at the same time, it was funereal.
It takes a lot to supplant the butt fumble as the most Jet thing ever, but I feel like this actually did it.
Yes. Yes. And the thing is, the butt fumble you can get over. I'm still trying to get over this.
Well, David, I appreciate you doing this. I appreciate your work on my behalf through the years.
My pleasure and an honor.
One day I'm going to write a book.
No shit.
One day I'm going to write a book. My next book is going to be the David Black story.
Right.
Thank you.
I want to thank today's guest, David Black, for joining me on True Riders Sing and Yang. You can learn more about David by switching onto the information superhighway and visiting his agency's website, davidblackagency.com. If you have a chance and enjoy True Riders Sing and Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the fantastic MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.